Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Queer Quadrant, a podcast where we, two bisexual filmmakers, examine cinema in all its cultural contexts and explore why your favorite four-quadrant blockbuster is maybe not as straight as you think it is.
You know what I found fascinating rewatching this movie that I had seen a couple times before was that, you know, a lot of movies about Jesus, you know, Jesus Christ, he's like the central focus of the movie. I would say like the movie revolves around him. It's about him. He's the lead, you know. This movie makes the wild decision of having him as the C-plot, I want to say. Maybe the D-plot of the movie?
Objectively better than if it was like the center of the movie. This is like if you're writing a Lord of the Rings movie and yes. You're like, I don't care about the quest to drop the ring in Mount Doom. I care about whatever is still going on in Hobbiton while
Absolutely. These
crazy people went off on an adventure. It's just so funny that this... Yes. Movie is essentially like Ben-Hur doing his thing, and then every once in a while Jesus runs by in yes. the background, and you're like, oh cool, I know, I remember that part from the Bible,
right?
Truly hilarious.
It's because it's also like the book has the title as well, but like it has like a tale of the Christ as its subtitle,
right?
So you're like, wow, okay, it's really gonna be Jesus heavy, but not really.
It's not. Well, but then,
But yes, no.
We'll get into
it. It's complex, I would say.
If you haven't guessed, hi, hello. I'm Brooke Solomon.
Jordan Gustafson. Sorry. I was like, wait, who am I?
There you
go. I am Ben-Hur.
You got too deep.
Jordan Ben-Hur.
Okay. And joining us today is cultural writer and all-around wonderful human, Mariah E. Gates. Hi, Mariah. Thank you so much for being here.
I am so excited to talk about this movie. I love this film.
Yeah,
I'm really glad that you picked this film because today we are talking the 1959 epic Ben-Hur.
Literal, yeah.
A true epic. And we love to cover old movies on this podcast because we feel like they don't really get their due in terms of thinking about like, ooh, subtext, like who's trying to do what behind the scenes. So it's always very exciting when we can cover a movie from the classic age of Hollywood. So I'm really glad you picked it.
When I saw it on the list of titles, I was like, yes, absolutely. This is the one.
Zeroed in.
Yeah. Yes. Like, yeah. Ben-Hur is, I have seen this movie. How old am I? I'm about to turn 35. So I've seen this movie at least 30 times.
Wow. Okay.
But so probably more though, because I've watched it every Easter my entire life, plus I saw it in theaters once, not on Easter.
Wow.
What was that like, seeing the theater? This in theater? Was that like epic?
I wish it were in a better circumstance. It was for the 60th, I can't do math, 2009. So whatever year that is. Is that 60 from 59?
You're asking the wrong people. I think that is 50 because it's 59.
I'm really bad at math.
So are we. Don't worry. Yeah.
So I saw it at the mall in San Francisco. It's really terrible. It's not an AMC. It's the Regal, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure what. It's a shitty theater. And it was like one of those like flashback favorites, only it was like 50th anniversary Ben-Hur. And there were only like three people there because it was like 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and it's like a 4-hour movie. And the sound was good, but it was, you know, it was like a digital projection, and it wasn't a lot of those mall digital projections of classic films. They don't know how to set the like light bulb right, or they don't even bother, and
they
never look great. And you know, it's such a great movie to see with like, I would assume to see with like a lot of people who care about it, because most classic films I've seen in theaters have seen impact, you know, like either at the TCM Film Festival or at the Castro or somewhere where the audience really cares. So it was kind of, it was almost like seeing it by myself because there were literally the three of us. but you know, I love this movie. So it was really fun to watch regardless. And you know, to the point of the podcast, it is extremely gay, and seeing that on the big screen was wonderful. So
you're like, oh,
you can really see the longing in 4K.
See, like Stephen Boyd is projecting a lot
Oh my god, he's doing so much.
Oh god, I can't wait
We have to talk about him.
I'm so glad that you have a long history with this movie. It was in the most shocking twist of all time.
I was gonna say this.
I do not.
How?
I know. I grew up Catholic, so
this
like,
is like the Solomon like... special of a movie. It has horses. It has Jesus.
Yeah.
It has like a long running time from the 50s. Like this is built for
it's
you.
About ancient Rome,
right? I'm like, how have you never seen this movie?
I know, I couldn't believe it. I guess it didn't make the religious movie rotation, but I mean it was probably too long.
They're like the Passion of the Christ.
I'm telling you, I only watched the Passion of the Christ in school. That okay. was not okay. a I also went to Catholic school, so I'm very surprised that they didn't show this.
I know,
in Catholic school again, it's probably just too long. It's so long.
It is a very long movie. And before my parents bought it on cassette tape, we had it on cassette tape, but before we found the cassette tape, we used to watch it when they would show it on TV, and that takes like 6 hours or something.
Right, because all the commercial
it just
breaks.
Keeps going.
It just keeps going.
It does. It does.
Like you think the plots are wrapping up, and then there's another three plots, and you're like, wait.
Yep, it's like the chariot race. You're like, ah, yes, the emotional climax of the movie. They're reunited. This is it.
Just kidding.
No.
It's so okay. So a couple of months ago, we talked about Heat, and I'll tell you the like culmination of the chariot race in this movie.
Totally. Yeah,
I was
it's
the same sort of energy when you're like, yes, the emotional climax of the central storyline of your movie. And then there's another 45 minutes.
And there's
of, like,
another whole other movie.
Right.
Because they have to get back to Jesus, you know.
Right.
You got
well, that's essentially
all
what it is. Like, the whole
end
of like the third act is really like Jesus.
Is just turns into like an Easter story. So very thematically appropriate.
That's why we watched it on Easter every year. It becomes an Easter movie. If you give it time.
Right.
Were you, so your races. Did your parents show you it or how did
you
first?
Yeah, my parents are really big film nerds. Like my mom would only buy widescreen VHS tapes back before DVDs existed because I'm old and I cut my teeth on VHS tapes. And
we
like,
remember
you know,
the VHS days.
Double, this one had at least two, maybe three
I was going to say, this one had to be a tour.
This is a lot of tapes. And I remember it had the whatever special edition VHS we had Martin Scorsese talking about why it needs to be widescreen.
Oh, that's amazing.
Like, here's why. because the chariot race, not widescreen, just looks like crap. It's
I can't even imagine watching it
not wide. It's ridiculous. But and then my mom is religious, so that's sort of how the movies were always in our life. And then she was religious, so we would watch Ben-Hur on Easter and the Ten Commandments on Passover. Oh,
so good. Yeah. Such a good film. We did watch that one
a big
lot
Heston house.
Heston there was a house. Lot of Heston going on, you know. And then my dad was a big Planet of the Apes fan, so there was
a lot of him in like loincloths and like very minimal clothing, just yelling about things.
Yeah.
Pretty much. I mean. Yeah. So when he, you know, when he was older and he ended up being so curmudgeonly, it really destroyed my childhood. I was like, man, shut up and look pretty.
Yeah.
Right. You're like,
seriously.
Why do you have to be great friends with Ronald Reagan?
Why must you be the head of the NRA?
Yeah. Right. It was really unfortunate, you know, because he was a favorite because of all these movies. He was a favorite actor. And then I was like, oh, he would hate me. Like, that's great.
Like, oh, no.
Good to know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, but Jordan, you watched this movie growing up as well.
I did. My father showed me because he was like, you have to see the chariot sequence. And this was also when he was like, you should watch more religious things to get like a well-rounded religious POV of the world.
I think that's a worthy endeavor.
Yeah. Didn't really pay off or anything.
Yeah.
In terms of me being very religious, but I have seen this thing, I think like 3 or 4 times. And I don't know, like for some reason, it was one of these things where I've seen it so much. And the chariot sequence I will constantly go back to because I mean, it is truly one of the most like harrowing sequences like ever, but I forgot that I had so much of this movie like deeply ingrained in my brain because I haven't seen it probably 10 years, I want to say.
Yeah.
I would say like probably 10 years. So it was like rewatching it last night was like a lot of these things coming back to me, especially like the leprosy subplots and like a lot of the third act. I had forgotten.
I really thought leprosy was still a big thing because of this movie. And I want to say it's Princess Di that was trying to help. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Or was it Audrey Hepburn? One of the two of them in the early 90s were like dealing with leprosy. And I was like, is leprosy really a big thing? And my mom's like, only in certain places. And I'm like, oh. Because I thought it was everywhere. I was always afraid.
I wrote that down as a note. I was like, I feel like leprosy, there was like leprosy in like some other parts of like films that like kept popping up that were like these points where I was like, I have to be worried about like this.
It
like this is a
Exiles.
Major thing.
It was on The Exiles too. And it's like,
oh my God.
It's not really as big a thing as pop culture made it seem.
Yeah.
No.
It is harrowing to those who have it. Yes.
Right.
But
of course.
Like, it's not, you know,
it makes it feel like you're going to walk around the corner and there will be like a leper colony versus like,
Lord.
It's actually like just very small pockets of places in the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was most familiar with it from the Bible because there is a lot of leprosy in the Bible.
Yes.
And a lot of healing.
Very much.
As in this movie.
Especially in the New Testament. Yeah, exactly. I know. They really came out of nowhere at the end. I was like, oh shit, he did it. They're
he
healed. Yeah, it's a great time. It's crazy.
You had seen Ten Commandments though, right?
Yes. Okay, I've seen Ten Commandments many a time. And there's like a Jesus of Nazareth miniseries.
Oh yeah.
See,
I've seen a lot of these like biblical films. My mom was very into them. Whenever there was a new one on TV, we were watching it. So
Yes. There is a do you remember there was like a modern Bible miniseries that was like the whole Bible?
Yes.
Remember this.
Yes.
It was called The Bible.
It was called The Bible.
Yeah.
There was also a kids series from Family Home Entertainment that was like archaeologists digging up Bible sites and then they would tell the Bible stories. And my parents are archaeologists. So it was like made that series literally for my brother and I, because it was like science and the Bible together.
Yes,
it was really
intense.
That's I don't know
wild.
That those are available anywhere. Hopefully someone put it on YouTube.
I have to think about them.
They're probably on YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah,
they were fun, or at least, you know, when I was six. I don't know.
There were these little animated like saint stories that they would show us in school when I was in elementary school that I feel like is sort of along the same lines. They were like little vignettes about like the different saints and stuff like that. Jordan just looks so flabbergasted
now. None of this.
You have
for
no
me.
Idea.
Absolutely not. They were just like, all of my stuff was just like patriotism and just like, here's like New England history.
But also like, you know, Jordan was very into like what you would expect kids to be into in the movie realm, like Star Wars Toy Story,
of course,
Legos.
Not biblical epics.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so, you know, you had like a commercial American childhood.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say though, watching this movie, it did make me really miss epics of a sort. Like, I really like that you had to like sit down and be like, okay, this is my whole evening, and like you're gonna get your prelude, you're gonna get an intermission, you're gonna get like all of this stuff, and it was like really enjoyable.
And the entr'acte.
Right.
Entr'acte.
That's
my
like
favorite.
A whole 5 minutes.
Right. You're like, oh my God, it's going.
Yeah.
And it's like that will never happen ever again.
No.
And it's a bummer because we'll still have like long movies. Like American Honey is over 3 hours. There could have been an entr'acte in there somewhere.
I mean, look, that's one of my favorite movies of all time. Totally
I love
agree.
That film.
Agree. Like that movie, like that could have like two intermissions. Like the thing is, you could throw that in wherever in that movie.
It will never happen again though, because this was when, you know, cinema was still like a theatrical. I mean, it obviously is a theatrical event, but like a high theater event.
Yeah,
like going to
black tie. You go to the cinema, and then there's an intermission in the middle, like there would be for a play.
Right,
because it's 4 hours long, and like there's no way you're making it through that thing.
And like epic movies, I think did make so much. I mean, like Titanic is I would say like an epic movie,
of
you know,
course.
Like Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. Like that's an epic film.
What an interesting two movies to mention, Jordan.
Exactly. Well, that was my point, is that those movies then like go on to be like huge Oscar successes. So you would think like we would still sort of like at least like have a drive to have those. But like, what was the last you would say? I mean, if you're talking about like historical epics, Robin Hood.
I have an unfortunate take to tell you, which is that it's now a 3-hour Avengers Endgame.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
That's the corollary now, and that's depressing in my opinion.
Right. It's like you would love like an original story. That's an epic. Yeah.
And
I can't follow the Marvel movies either because I didn't keep up with them. So like I saw the original like Phase One before it was called Phase One, right? And then I stopped watching them, and then I tried to watch Captain Marvel to support, you know, like female directors, and I was so lost. I had to Google things when it was over to figure out what was happening. It was really, I'm it's afraid like the same lore. Thing's gonna happen with Black Widow. I'm like, I'm not gonna understand Black Widow at all.
I'm worried about not understanding Black Widow, and I have seen literally every Marvel property ever.
They are getting very like about.
Granular?
Deep and insular, yeah. And like a lot of things are coming back. We are like these micro characters.
And like, do you have to watch WandaVision to understand the other stuff too? I don't know.
I think you're gonna have
to. And Loki, and I'm not watching all of it. I'll just sit it out and like be that person, you know, in the group when people are talking about Marvel, where I'm like, I don't know anything. Grew up in a cave.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, no. It is unfortunate because I feel like a lot of the epic stuff now too, or what we would think of as traditional epics, has moved to TV, and like they're these huge, like big budget, like Game of Thrones, such an epic, like Westworld, an epic, sort of.
Right,
yeah.
Like Rome or whatever.
Vikings, Black Sails, my personal favorite. Black Sails is a good epic. We'll let that one slide. But it's very weird. It feels like that type of movie has just sort of quietly slipped away.
Because it's high risk, high reward, but not guaranteed.
So now
it's like if you don't get if you're not going to get that reward, are you going to be able to gamble making one of the most expensive movies, if not the most expensive movie ever made, right?
Yeah, and now it's like only James Cameron can make a theatrical epic, or only Steven Spielberg can make a theatrical
epic. But even Spielberg, I mean, like what?
He's making
Lincoln?
West Side Story.
Like I don't know if that's like an epic,
I don't,
though,
well,
you know?
I agree. I don't think that he's actually doing it, but he could.
Right, if we want
if
to.
He,
like,
if
use
he wanted
cachet.
To, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it is sad.
I know, it is.
Maybe they'll come back.
But yes, one day. I do think, since you mentioned the Oscars in passing, it is worth it to just like state very clearly that there are three movies tied for most Oscars ever. 11 Oscars won.
Incredible.
You gotta get the stats, and it's Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, and it's Titanic. And we thought La La Land was gonna get there.
No.
Thankfully it did not.
That was wild when they were like, La La Land's gonna sweep it all. This is the one, and we're like, oh.
Please God, no.
This one, I feel like the best supporting actor went to the wrong performance.
Could not agree more.
His Hugh Griffith, right? His performance has not aged well. It's like one of the least good parts about the movie. Mm-hmm. And Masala's performance, Stephen Boyd as Masala, has just gotten more and more relevant.
Yes.
And it's like they totally messed up.
I completely agree.
He's so good. And it's like, spoilers, but it's like, it's the greatest death scene in era, at least in the 50s, if not of all time. He's so good.
Yeah,
he's on a whole other level.
Incredible prosthetic, like makeup work too. Like his arms, like they look, how they incorporate like the blood and the dirt to make him look just like grimy as he's like writhing
and
on the bed.
How is he gasping like that? Like, how did he make his voice sound like that? It's amazing.
Yeah.
I think Boyd is the MVP. Like,
no question.
Yes.
Like, Heston is definitely like, I mean, like, the thing I think with Heston is you have to be on board with whatever energy he's going to bring you, because I don't think, like, he's doing his own sort of acting for every movie he's in, like Planet of the Apes, like all of his acting is always like Heston doing him sort of a thing.
Heston doing Heston.
Versus like acting for the movie necessarily.
I would
so
agree.
Like Boyd, I feel like, is so locked in the pocket of like what this movie's actually trying to say. Like, I think he's so phenomenal in all of his scenes. Like, you get like the aura of like self-importance that he like exhumes, and just his chin as well is doing so much.
Jordan's really into his chin.
His double chin is doing so much acting.
He's a cutie.
He has one of the great chins.
He really does.
Yes. I think that what you said is very smart, though, because it's like, and we talk about this often, supporting actors so often have so much more room to like play a good character, because Heston has to root this whole movie. Like, he, even if he has a moment of weakness or whatever, it has to be like so beholden to like maintaining the aura of who Ben-Hur is. Like, he has to be a hero at all times, even in his moments of weakness. And like, it's no, he doesn't have fun with it. And like, I think that Stephen Boyd's performance is obviously like very grounded, and like, it's a very good dramatic performance, but also he has the room to like have a little bit of fun. The whole whip cracking scene when he whips someone's bowl off the table.
Oh my goodness.
It's great. Yes. Yeah.
When they're throwing their spears at the beginning.
Well, let's just.
The spear work in this movie, incredible. Like, when he is, like, they're arguing, and Heston, he's like, kill me. And Heston throws the spear dramatically into the wall next to him, like, not to kill him. And they're both just, like, fraught with emotions. You're like, oh my
staring
God.
Staring into each other's
these
eyes.
Two men literally love each other.
Yeah.
It's really intense. I used to work at Filmstruck. Do you guys remember Filmstruck?
Of course. Yes.
So I made a ton of gifts of this movie for Filmstruck. So if you ever have found like a Ben-Hur Filmstruck branded gif,
I made a ton of them
because
we'll use it for the the Twitter.
I made a ton of them because as you guys know, you just watched it, there's a lot of great reactions in this film, and like so many reactions.
Yes.
And that's my favorite kind of thing to make a gif of, is like a strong reaction, a strong emotion. And there's few films I feel like have as many just emotion filled reaction moments as this film. And particularly when it's the two of them together, because it's all reactions. I just love it so much.
it's so good.
It's so great.
It's so much just reacting.
Capital
to like, like
A
big
acting
statements.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. This is like old school melodrama acting. I mean, obviously this is like heralded as one of like the great epics, like greatest epic of all time, very serious, very grounded, but I like love we I obviously did a lot of research on Woke King Gore Vidal. And I'm really obsessed with him calling this movie like high camp and like, you know, wonderful trash and stuff like that. Like, he seems to understand the level of melodrama.
Yes.
Like how it's playing out on screen, when I think that how this movie was taken for the most part was like ultra serious, very important, a capital F film. And he's like, guys, come on.
We have to say the quote that he has about like Masala and her in this movie is truly like my favorite thing of all time, which is he wrote like what he said about like writing is that the only way that one could justify several hours of hatred between two lads and all those horses was to establish, without saying so in words, an affair between them as boys. Then when reunited at picture start, the Roman Boyd wants to pick up where they left off, and the Jew Heston spurns him. Like, he knows that you have to, like, the entire movie has to be framed upon like these two men having past love and breaking up, and it like causing essentially the entire movie play out. Like,
and kind of what is so wonderful once you watch the movie with that reading. So obviously, like, I grew up with this movie, and I did not grow up with it as presented as a queer classic. Like, that's not how my parents talked about it. That's not what I got from it as a kid. And then I watched The Celluloid Closet. That's the first time I came across it being a queer film and Gore Vidal talking. And I was like, wait a minute, what? I've seen this movie a million times. I rewatched it. And the stuff with Masala is very obvious. But even when, you know, when Ben-Hur is like now riding in the ramming speed boat and all that, his relationship with, so in the book, so my mom's read the book. She used to tell me about the book and the differences, and she would always complain. In the book, like, Ben-Hur becomes the governor's, whoever that guy is, his legal son and heir and all of these things. He adopts them, all this stuff. And they kind of changed it a bit. But if you watch it with a queer lens, it's almost like he is now like, that's his sugar daddy. And it feels, yes, you can feel that energy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like a father-son energy.
No.
At all.
No.
And it's really intense when you think, like Heston didn't know what he was doing, but it had already been established. And then did the other actor know? Or am I just reading into it? I'm not sure, but it's definitely there. And then, you know, and then when Masala dies and he's so upset. And Esther is still trying, to make this relationship work. And you're like, girl, stop. He doesn't
it's
like
so
you.
It's so tertiary. It's completely, like, irrelevant to
I
the
plot. I didn't even think that they were going to lean as hard into, like, how useless the relationship is as they did with Ben-Hur, right, being like, would be so stupid of you to love me. Like, I can't do it. I'm too obsessed with revenge.
He pushes her away so many times.
Yeah.
And she just keeps coming back. And you're like, Esther, stop.
Girl. Well, you gotta
he
take
is
a
not
hit.
For you.
I'm so glad, Mariah, though, that you mentioned the rowing scene, because the whole time I was watching it, it's like essentially like a test of wills, as I'm sure what it's supposed to represent, but like it's very charged, and
yes, it is
their
insane.
Eyes locked,
the eye contact, and like they're both dripping with sweat. He's obviously like pumping oars like it's nobody's business, and the way that it's edited, like
it's the editing. And then when he saves him and they're on the raft,
then
they're all shirtless. It's like
he's holding him, it's like a Dom sub sort of position.
Ooh,
that like flips.
Okay, that's
true.
Exactly,
sorry, but
that's exactly it. I a couple years ago I did like a live tweet on Easter, but only pointing out the gay stuff basically. And like I think that's literally the tweet that I wrote. It was like experimenting in BDSM, and it's like him
holding him with the chain. Yes.
Okay.
That's what it's like.
We'll link that thread because I feel like it's very important.
Chain link the thread.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's one of the best. I think it's one of the best Twitter threads I've ever done.
That sounds incredible.
No question.
I very much cherry picked the moments that look the gayest, but it's like they're there. So
it's like sometimes with these movies, it's like you're like, oh, okay, I'm gonna have to look for this, or it's gonna be really buried subtext, but it's so up front and center. And the thing is, I think it's hilarious, is like Heston, obviously, like they didn't tell him these things because he was an ultra conservative and they were like, he would flip his shit, which he would of course go on to do.
Yes.
But it's funny because like he's so playing into it without necessarily knowing about it. Yeah. So it's like everyone around him knows, maybe, or at least like maybe Boyd does, you know what I mean? But like
Boyd knew
for sure.
Yeah.
But Heston is giving the same energy, but he thinks that it's like so self-serious, but by being so self-serious and sincere, it's playing into like the theatricality and sort of the camp and like the queerness of the character.
Yeah.
So it works.
That's something we talk about so often too, is like a bunch of ultra straight guys got together and made what they thought was an ultra straight movie, and it's secretly a gay romance, and isn't that great for them? But like this, I feel like, is the perfect example of it, where it's like you have Vidal talking to director William Wyler and being like, I think we should do this, and Wyler being like, okay, I'm gonna tell Stephen Boyd because he's a professional, but like we gotta keep Heston out of this.
Trump.
He can't know. And then like to have it play out on screen with those exact roles established is just it's so
and
good.
It fits in nicely with a lot of these like Sword and Sandal, like some of the later Sword and Sandal films are also really gay,
like
the ones that were made I'm thinking of like the ones that were made in Italy. There's a whole bunch of them in late 50s but mostly early 60s of like there's one called Samson and Hercules or something like that. There's a whole bunch of them. And I watched a bunch of them because one of my old jobs was at Warner Archive Collection, and they released like a ton of these. And, you know, they're made in Italy, and they really lean into the fact that, like, that was the culture. And I always kind of wonder, like, sometimes you're like, did the filmmakers know? Hard to say. Did audiences... you know, the mainstream audiences that watched it probably didn't have much vocabulary, so they didn't see it, right? But like the queer people who watched it, I'm sure knew, like, and were like, wow, this is for me, but they don't even know it. And then that's why something like Ben-Hur in 1959, it can win 11 Oscars, and nobody, you know, I grew up watching it and had no idea it was queer. And then with the vocabulary we have now, you look back at it and you're like, wait, this isn't even all that subtexty. It just was subtext because the subtext was a language that people didn't have.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's wonderful.
That's why documentaries like The Celluloid Closet, which is just like one of the best things that I've ever seen, are so exciting because they talk about all these films that I think, yeah, you do have to like program your brain a specific way to see it. But once you've programmed it, you like can't go back.
Yeah,
I mean,
you can't unsee it.
They just talk about so many movies in that documentary that like we have talked, you know, some of them we've talked about, a lot of them we like plan to talk about in the future. And basically all of them, you're like, yeah. Like, it's crazy that it took people being like, yes, this was the explicit intention and I couldn't tell anyone because it was a different time, to like understand that like that is what made it to the screen. I mean, that's essentially what the podcast is all about, right? So it's yeah, I'm so glad that Vidal has a segment in The Celluloid Closet, because we haven't talked about the doc very much on Mike, and it's like an invaluable piece of like historical
it's such a good documentary. Yeah. And really truly points out things that like it's so obvious when you go back and watch the things, but
oh my god.
A lot of the stuff you know were films I had seen, and then I watched that documentary and I was like, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. You rewatch it and you're like, dang, how did they get away with this?
Yes. Right.
Like Rebecca or all those, you're just like, what did I miss? And like, cause like you'll have, like we had Rebecca taught to us in like 10th grade or whatever in school. And there you go through the book, like in an English class, you're hyper analyzing this book and you don't talk about the queer themes, but then you go back and watch it and like read it and you're like, it's right there. Like, why did we not engage with this?
Yes. All that we hope for.
I feel like a lot of like literature, high school level literature teachers, maybe, you know, back when I was in high school, which now I realize was almost 20 years ago and I hate that. But I would hope that they're a little more progressive about it now, but who knows. But like there's several other books that I read from that era that are very queer, like The Turn of the Screw.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
I wrote my entire AP essay about how queer that book is, but my teacher didn't talk about it. I had just read it elsewhere. Mm. And was like, well, this is what I'm writing about because this is what I'm into. And then I took a college class covering that book, and she didn't talk about it being queer either. And I was like, wait a minute.
What is going on here?
Like, why are you avoiding this?
I'm not the wild one. It's there.
it's there.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about The Great Gatsby on Mike, which I feel like is a book.
The most like covered book.
Right. Historically. And that's never talked about. I mean, A Separate Piece is another book that I remember reading that's like very much in the same zone, when you're like, this is about like being gay at boarding school, but it's never discussed.
Yeah.
It's really all that we can hope for is to like bring more awareness to stuff like this and to like force people to like look at it through this lens, which is why stuff like The Celluloid,
I think,
I think
that's a really smart way to go about it, especially for like popular cinema, because obviously the canonical queer classics were queer for the most part always, right?
Right.
And have always been discussed that way. And I think that a lot of people think, oh, well, there's only like these 10 movies, so there weren't all that many queer people. And, you know, it's like they look at the statistics today and say, you know, like 50% of Gen Z says they're queer, right? Something like that. I don't think it's 50%, but it's like a huge number. And it's they're high, like, oh, they're, you know, it's catching or whatever. And it's like, I think most people were actually always that way.
It was
they just were repressed.
Yeah.
Or afraid, or any number of things. Like, the numbers haven't changed. It's just the ability to be yourself has changed.
Right. And we talk about, like, we've mentioned James Whale and stuff like that. Like, people don't realize how early, like,
Bride of Frankenstein is incredibly gay. That is a gay movie.
So much of his, like, his whole filmography is just, like, so queer-coded. And, like, obviously, like, he was out. But, like, from like the dawn of cinema, there were queer directors infusing queerness into genres and their movies, and people like not being able to like understand that. I think it's just such a fascinating concept, because it's not like queer people just popped out of nowhere.
Exactly.
It's just,
which is what people, I think a lot of people think.
Right.
They
just
think the numbers
true.
Have changed. Or, you know, another great example is like trans cinema has existed since the silent era, but suddenly, you know, because trans people are a little more safe. I'm not going to say they're safe, but they're a little more safe now. there's more of them in contemporary pop culture. And so people are like, oh, they didn't, you know, like, all there's TERFs can get really nasty about, like, you know, it's not how it always was. And it's like, they're no, like, it was literally always this way. And
right.
And then you're only looking at it from Western perspective. You know, there's certain cultures that had, like, two spirits and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
For thousands of years. It's just we didn't have the language. And it's I don't know. It's much more complicated than, oh, the numbers have changed suddenly. It's like, no.
Yeah. It's amazing what people will ignore, like, just through sheer force of will because they don't agree with it. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, Mariah, you wrote an amazing article for Nerdist, right?
Yeah.
About, like, really early queer cinema and as early, like, as, like, yeah, like you guys
said. I think the earliest I had was 1914. But there were some earlier ones that are sort of – like there's one with two men kissing that's from like 1898, I think.
My
but I didn't include that because it's like literally 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, right.
But like
right.
As soon as you were putting moving images on video.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, it's the reason we had the production code and the reason we had to have these coded films like Ben-Hur was because early cinema was so gay that.
They got
they
scared.
Were like, we need to shut this down,
right? Like, the Hays Code is just so much like a function of like reactionary to like things, and it's like you have that with the MPAA. Like so many of the restrictions that get placed on cinema is because things and movements start happening that are so up front and center that they're like, okay, how can we label this and how can we contain this so that way this like doesn't infect like America and like our children's minds, rather than like just like allowing this like open conversation. And like obviously like you can't stop people from putting things into movies, so they're just gonna find a workaround, as we've seen, whether that be with like subtext, etc. Like it's gonna find a way to get into the movie no matter what. You can't stop it.
And I love like when Public Reckonings, as public as like Ben-Hur, come out. I mean, look, first of all, this movie from 1959 is a remake of
a silent film.
You know, the remake model was there, but I remember when they remade this movie very ill-advised.
Oh, God.
In 2016, there was, I think, like, that was where a big spike in these articles about, like, the original queer subtext of Ben-Hur came from with the remake coming out, because all of the creative team that they asked in the remake about it, they were like, well, it's not a part of it anymore because we feel like we don't need to do that because times are better now and we feel like we don't need that representation
on screen. Literally direct quote from Toby Keppel.
Yeah, like, where he's like, we don't really need that anymore.
Right.
Luckily,
like,
it's
we're
a lot.
Woke enough.
It's a better time. And I was like, it's.
Yeah. It's also, it's you so know, funny. One of the quotes from Vidal was like, you can't, you know, like, the politics is not enough for a 3-hour movie. Like, it's boring.
Right.
Right. I'm not quoting directly, but that's what happened with that remake is like, they. They made a literal version of this book from, what is the book from like 1912 or something?
It's from like it's 1880s.
1880s. It's a really old book. And they tried to do like a literal version. And it's like, it didn't age well.
Not good.
Nobody wants that.
And then all the CGI just.
Right,
like,
exactly.
I know that's not related to the queer subtext at all. But like the
CGI
is just so boring. It's like.
Well, that's the thing with this movie is, I mean, it's. One of the most like no matter whether you're like if you like the plot or not or however you feel about the story, like just literally just the act of just like watching this movie is amazing because of just all of the effort that went into like the production design, the cinematography, the extras, the costumes, like everything is so
it's
grand.
The score,
the
right.
score.
This is one of my top 10 favorite scores of all time. Miklos Rosa like went. It is like the I'm it's running through my head right now that like the main theme,
yeah,
you know, it's got such a beat to it. It's like it's so good.
It's great.
It made me very emotional when the score kicked in at the end when I was like thinking about like the Ben-Hur Masala journey. I was like getting a little choked up all of a sudden. It's such a powerful score.
You had texted me while we like were watching.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You find
the transcription.
You basically just like the music swells, like has an emotional swell when the two of them are together. That's not, it's not it like it's like it a romantic does. Swell.
It,
like
it is. Builds it's like and a it's classic like classic romantic swell.
Exactly,
it's
like perfect. You would put yes. that with like a Return to Home, and there's like the wife on the homestead. You know what I think? Like whatever like 1940s movie that would be. You know what I mean? But instead yeah. of like that, it's him and Masala reuniting.
Yes,
it's like in Dr. Zhivago. Like Lara's theme is this emotional sweeping thing every time Zhivago sees Lara, right? And it makes you feel what he feels for her, and that is right. exactly what Mikel Rosa did with the score for the two of them.
Yes,
yes. Same exactly. emotional feeling. It's lovely. It's... Which is why I think everyone was in on it. Like, there's no way
totally.
He just did that and was no. like, these bros, like,
just guys just hanging out
a lot for each other.
I'm telling you, the romantic score, my text verbatim was, wait, not the romantic music kicking in the second yeah. they do the elbow locking drinking
well,
thing.
Well, yeah, that they literally, like, do the arm thing that lovers do with wine. I'm like,
it's very hot.
That's not... You only do that when you're dating someone.
When he's like, I said I'd come back, and then Heston is like, I didn't think you would. It's like, right. what is this dialogue?
I the it's one so that funny. The exchange that I wrote it. Down, which is after the spear throwing sequence, and we should go like minute by minute through the first yeah. 20 minutes until they start fighting, because then it's just sort of sad. But yeah. the exchange I wrote down, which is directly after their little spear throwing / dick brushing contest, whatever you want to call it, I don't know. there, I think it's Ben-Hur who's like still close, and Masala goes in every way.
In every way.
And Ben-Hur yeah. goes, I hope so. Like, hello, what is this?
Unbelievable.
What is this?
It's amazing. It is like, yeah. oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
It's the way the two, because the cinematography, we haven't mentioned his name, but Robert Elswertes, who did it. You see like the color and like the detail of like the CinemaScope is you get so much detail in their emotions and like can pick up on so much of like the way that they're going in their environment because you have like the long takes. Right. So you're seeing the sweat and you see the way that they're like blocked and moving throughout the scenes, and it's super intimate, and it's like because you're like not cutting around anything, you are seeing so much body language mm-hmm. that you often won't see. And because it's not shot in close-ups a lot of the time, you're able to see like the entirety of like how they're sort of like moving and touching things. And it becomes like these subtle, especially Boyd, not Heston, but like yes. Boyd, like picking up or like holding things or like touching and like hold, you know, it's like these minor details where you're like, you know exactly what yeah. you're doing and trying to like show the past relationship between the two of
and
you.
Yeah. Masala has a line in this scene where he goes, is there anything so sad as unrequited love?
Yes.
And you're like, okay. Yeah.
Eyebrow
Masala's
raised.
The
Come
one
on.
Here with the unrequited love. Like clearly
he's putting it out there. He's like, yes,
just
you,
saying
you?
It's really sad. I mean, that comes immediately after Ben-Hur being like, oh, you know, my sister was always in love with you, and Masala was like, uh-huh.
He's like, sure.
Yeah, that's so like, funny.
Oh, unrequited love, so
ooh,
sad.
It sucks for her. Yes, I mean, amazing. I was just not expecting there, because after the entr'acte and a super quick nativity story
right.
that takes
right.
up like right. 5 minutes. Can't
oh
forget about that. It like it just bombs extremely quickly into like the gay lovers portion of this movie for 25 minutes.
What is
I
that?
Was not ready.
The whiplash. I always forget that it opens with a nativity scene. You're like, okay, it's going to be the story of Jesus. And then they're like, psych, that's for act three.
Just kidding. Remember this guy. We'll come back to
well,
him right. later.
I think, what's lovely, though, is the way they try to set it up. It doesn't quite work, and maybe it works better in the book, I'm not sure, is that it's to show that like you have Jesus, and Jesus was this huge, you know, force for the world historically and or however you want to look at it, right? And then you had these other guys that were the same age growing up at that same time, and like I think they're attempting to put perspective of like here's mm-hmm. the
yeah.
here's the schism that was happening
totally
that Christ rose through, right? Whether you believe in history or whatever you want to, you know, however you want to look at it.
Yeah.
And what's depressing is that, like, the the fascism of it all wins. And it's like, no. That's,
yep.
But
yep.
But it's also hard, kind of hard to watch when you're watching it with the queer lens, and the queer character, the very queer character, is the fascist. You're like,
yeah.
Dang
yeah.
it. Like, and is it because he's so othered that he falls easily into fascism? I would like to think that that's what it is, so that it's not like queers are evil.
Right, queers are evil. Right, the most exhausting trope ever.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. And so I find that really interesting about the film, because it's like, would he have been this horrible if he hadn't been rejected?
Right. And it's like, it's so crazy that it's like an ideological rejection and not ostensibly a romantic rejection. The idea is that Ben-Hur's like, I would still like to be friends. I just disagree with you fundamentally. And then it like spins out of control.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I was wondering about that too, because I also think that this movie obviously leans a lot on like the debauchery of Rome and like the paganism of Rome and, you know, all of like the party sequences with the different like dancers and everything, and like
the whole bath scene.
Yeah, too, that also. Too. Which
also
we'll talk about that. but yeah, I think that that is sort of like playing into the idea too, that it's like he has no choice because he's like indoctrinated into Rome. I mean, Ben-Hur even has that line too. I mean, I think it's to Pontius Pilate at the end of the movie, where he's like, Messala was a good man before Rome ruined him.
Mm.
So it's the idea that it's like, are we drawing a direct comparison between Rome and like queerness? Are we saying that like, is it fascism? Is it othering? Is it like some whole melting pot of the whole thing? Because I think like, you know, the most obvious thematic pull from the movie is that like Christianity is good and paganism is bad. But there's a lot at play. What were you gonna say?
No, I completely agree. I think there's also, we had talked about this too, but it's like, I think like this being an American movie, and so many times like these big epics and just like our Western POV on society is like so much of like the underdog, and like you're rooting sort of for this poor, you know, Heston, and like these people who are like oppressed by society, but not recognizing that like we as like America and like the West are pretty much like
colonizers.
Like we are the ones who are doing these terrible things to these people. And so like you wonder if we're looking at like the POVs, it like, is Messala oppressed by like the American system and like the way like in which like people at the time were forced to like stay suppressed by like American views, and as we were saying, like the way that America like tried to suppress like queer cinema through like these like codes, etc. So
yeah.
But then again, that's like really giving a lot to like the directors or writers to be like thinking about. And I think it is more of something that you would like have with this removed POV. But, you know.
Yeah, I would agree. I feel like that's something that can be read into it, but wasn't necessarily intended. But exactly. I also do think that so I'm a really big fan of David Lynch, and he doesn't like to talk about what his art, because he very specifically says, there's a great book called Lynch on Lynch where he has this great quote where he basically like, he put what he had to say into the film. And then when the film is watched by the viewer, because they are, each individual viewer is a different person. They have their own perspectives. Art is different for every single person who views it. Right. That's why he doesn't like to talk about it, because what you watched isn't what he made. And what you watched isn't what he made, and what you watched isn't what you watched.
Right.
You watched it together. And I feel very strongly that with cinema, and this is why I don't think there's ever a definitive read on anything ever, because the art and artists, there's so many people, thousands of people work on a movie. Who knows what the alchemy made? And whatever it is that you see in it is what you see in it, because of what they put, and what they put is then, you know, read through what you've lived through. And so that's why I think that's why that's talking about movies is so rich, is because you can, there are literally thousands of reads of every movie, probably millions of reads if a million people actually watch a movie and can, you know, think about it deeply. But that's why I think that like that is a valid, that could be a very valid read, even if Vidal did not intend that.
Yeah.
No, completely agree. And I think that's where we as a society, you see this flame up a lot. And I'm like, I won't like name a specific just because it's like dated at this point. But like with like, we'll talk about like shipping sometimes of like, which shipping. Is what we're doing essentially now. Not necessarily, but
I
like,
ship it. I ship
of
it.
Of course we ship them. yes. But it's like people will get upset at queer people or sometimes for like shipping these like relationships when... Mm-hmm. It's not like an issue, and it's really just as we were saying, it's like on how like the individual is seeing something, and there isn't inherently anything wrong with you seeing a queer relationship between these people because it makes your experience richer and it makes your experience what your experience is, and like the whole point is for you to get emotionally out of what a movie whatever you want. Yes. And so like when like an author or an actor or whatever gets upset about it, it's like why are you upset if what this person is experiencing is exciting for them versus like what your definitive take is. Like you're creating a piece of art and you're putting it out into the world. Like it's going to be interpreted. So like, why not let people interpret it however the frickin' hell they want to interpret
yeah.
it.
Yeah. You should be honored that people right. think your work is queer. Right. that's
yes.
I mean,
if you're going to become yeah. a queer classic, that rules for you,
that's,
man.
That's good for you. I mean, that's where all the discussions between like canon and fanon come in, blah, blah, right. blah, et cetera. So like, you know, when you do get
that's
yeah.
like why I love Hannibal so much.
Oh
right?
my God.
Hannibal was taken by queer women and they were like, this is gay. And Brian Fuller also being gay was like, you know what?
He was like,
sure.
Yes,
it is gay.
You know
what?
These are the people who are watching it. They're the most vocal fans. Let's just give them what they want, even though that's not what we originally intended.
Right.
And that third season is amazing. People call it self-indulgent and they're dumb.
Nonsense. It's
like,
perfect.
They're wrong. That's
he
the
was
one time
tweeting about how, like, he tweets all the time about it. And he's like, happy yeah. Pride, fanables. I'm like, yeah. he, like, it's... Yeah. Right there.
I don't know a better man than Brian Fuller. You have no idea what you've unlocked. Like the depths of like how much I care about NBC Hannibal
yes.
is
like
truly
insane. I used to work at Rotten Tomatoes and I got to attend the cast premiere of season 3.
That was
like not the whole cast, but Freddie Lyons is from Philip Seymour Hoffman. Okay, yeah. Anyways, she was there. One of the guys was there. I'm forgetting which one. Not the main. If Mads was there, I would have been dead. Yeah. Brian Fuller was there. Don Mancini was there. God, it was amazing.
It was
an amazing premiere, and I will forever be grateful for that job. Getting that. I think I still have a cookie that says eat the rude on it. Like
that's
I kept it
cool.
And it's like probably a dead cookie now, like don't eat it.
No,
but like it's
you
a
can
fun
preserve
display
it
cookie.
Forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
well,
I
it's an experiment to see how long edible ink can stay legible.
I love that. It's a journey.
Yeah, but the point is that like I think that that's a healthy way to like look at it. It's like
yeah.
this is what the audience sees and this is good.
Yes.
I'm glad they're engaging with the art. How are they engaging?
Yeah. No. I'm so obsessed with NBC Hannibal for that specific reason. And that like Brian Fuller is one of the only showrunners I can think of who is like, oh, people are shipping this. That's cool. Let's like actually make that happen
right.
in like a good way. Like obviously there are
other
examples. Yeah,
and not a queer baiting way.
Right.
All.
Like
no.
it's real.
So good.
Oh my God. Oh, that show makes me go insane. Truly insane.
Yes. I love it so much.
Yeah. But it's always exciting because we don't get too much of it to see people. I mean, I'm leaning real hard on Gore Vidal, but what can I say? The man's an icon. Like to have him come out and talk about this kind of stuff and like to defend it. I mean, I remember I think it was after the Celluloid Closet documentary came out that Charlton Heston sort of like caught wind of this and
wrote to Time magazine
and rebuffed it and was like, that was so wrong, like I don't even know.
He was like basically saying that like Wyler like didn't have any like contributions to the script, which are then sort of rebuffed because like another like author or sorry like a critic at the time like compared the drafts and was like, no, like he did work on
no,
the script.
Vidal did. He he's a credited screenwriter, like he enough of his work like was baked into the text that like he was able to still be credited.
Can't discount it. Yeah.
I would just like to quickly read some excerpts from Gore Vidal's response to Heston's claim that it wasn't gay, which was in The Advocate from 1996. So yes, this is when Charlton Heston
today
wrote Time Magazine. Yeah. It is so spicy. Vidal responded via The Buzz. I think we must all be charitable when it comes to Charlton Heston, whose career peaked with the film Ben-Hur, kitsch now camp. Over the years, I have told the story of how I wrote a love scene for Ben-Hur and Missala, and how only Stephen Boyd was told what the scene was about. Because according to director William Wyler, Chuck would fall apart. Talking about Charlton Heston. Ahem. In numerous accounts of a marvelously dull life, Chuck has told us of his triumph as Ben-Hur. With each version, he adds, alas, new lies. The facts, and then he like goes through being like, I fucking wrote for Ben-Hur. These are the days that I spent. I spent like 8 weeks on it. Blah, 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 blah. And then my favorite part at the end. Despite Chuck's denial of the famous love scene, the reviewers who watched The Celluloid Closet saw very clearly what I had done and said so. Incidentally, one Celluloid Closet producer got a message from homophobe Heston. Damn. assuring him that a character he had also acted on screen, Michelangelo, was in no way homosexual. But what is one to do when the spokesperson of the National Rifle Association, who, when he quote-unquote acts now, wears two toupees, one on top of the other, in the interest in verisimilitude? Basically, like, it's the greatest right. roast that I've ever yeah. heard of yeah, him being like,
read him for filth.
I know. Oh, like, Heston's such a snowflake that we had to tell him that Michelangelo was straight just so he wouldn't have a breakdown.
Like, yeah. That's intense.
It's so funny.
It's so funny. Oh my god.
Gore Vidal, woke king.
Truly, truly.
I love him.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I miss those days. Like, I really wish, like, that sort of drama could the come tea. Back where you would have to take the out, tea. Like, an article on someone instead of just, like, sending something. Right. Like, that's yeah. very iconic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. I mean, you know, in, like, 20 years, we're going to have... I mean, we do already have, like, tweets in, like, the National Archives that are, like, preserved right. for...
It's like Ellen's selfie and stuff like that from yeah. the Oscars or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And, like, there's going to be beef... on from Twitter
beef
that's
gonna
be preserved. Yeah, I love that. It's crazy. Not like the good old days when you had to slam someone in print. The there's best. Just the dramatics.
Can we, you know, I'm gonna take out an article
about
on you
me.
And you could take one on me. It'll just like invent beef between us.
It's
I think
cool.
that'll be good.
We'll plug the podcast at the end. It'll right, drum yeah. up some nice publicity.
Yeah. Why don't we move into production. I would say like production and like the plot of what's going on, because I think that those things are very much worth talking about, because I mean, this movie, the most expensive movie ever made
at the time,
yeah. Which is incredible. And I mean, just the amount of extras that they had
talk about it. What do we got?
Okay, let me find the number. So they had 9 months of production, 3 months alone for the chariot sequence.
Bananas!
Which is crazy. Yeah. They shot 1,100,000 feet of film. They had 200 camels, 2,500 horses, and 10,000 extras.
My God.
10,000 extras. They were rejecting 3,000 people a day while they were shooting in Italy.
Wow.
Like, that's... I mean, but you can see it, though, is every single shot is packed with people, and I love that, and it gives just such a grand sense to it. Like, it would be CGI now, and
yeah,
it wouldn't
be a bunch
work.
Of CGI, you know, that they... copy-pasted and then right. tried to quasi-make look like, you know, I'm not the biggest Lord of the Rings fan, so I'm sorry if I'm offending Lord of the Rings
no,
fans.
No.
But like, you can tell in the big crowd sequences in Lord of the Rings that it's not real people and
right.
or, you know, real, you know, whatever.
Real elves.
Real elves.
What have you.
But, you know, it's not like people playing the elves. It is copy-paste CGI. It's really well done CGI, but it's very clearly CGI. And same thing with like, in Harry Potter, you know, all the Quidditch mm-hmm. scenes, like those aren't yeah. people in the, and I'm sure the new Space Jam is like,
oh god, I don't even want to think about it.
Oh, no.
Right? It's
yeah.
like, I love these films, specifically the 50s, like epics, because they were trying to get people to like leave I Love Lucy and their couch and like watch movies again. And so they were like, okay, I Love Lucy has 1,000 chocolates. We have 1,000 people. It's better. You know,
it's, that it's should amazing. Be the tagline.
Yeah. And yeah. Now history repeats itself. You know, we're trying to get people out of their houses back yeah. to the cinemas. And all they can come up with is Space Jam 2 and Mortal Kombat. Like, give come me big on. Epics.
I will say, though, if I saw this poster, I would be running out of the house to go see this movie. It is one of the most iconic posters, just it Ben, rocks. Her, and like the statues and the chariot in front. Like, yeah. it's so good.
Yeah, it rocks. I'm sure yeah. a lot of this movie was sold on the promise set pieces, like oh, the sea battle sure. or the chariot race.
They built, Brooke, they built a artificial lake to shoot that with miniatures.
Yeah, it's on one of the back lots, right?
Yes,
yeah.
they had 300 sets, 9 sound. Like, this thing, it's just like reading the facts about it. You're like, how did they do, like, how did you could coherently do this? It's in, like, how?
Wyler? How? Wyler is a pro. And apparently he didn't have a lot of faith in himself for making this movie. Like, he didn't think that he was the right person for the job.
It's not even really his kind of film. Like, no. That was the first Wyler film I ever saw. And then when I went and watched his other films, I was like, what? What?
Right.
Like, no, this isn't even the kind of movies he made.
Right. It's like interpersonal dramas. You have like Roman Holiday, or you have, you know, a movie that we'll eventually cover with The Children's Hour. And like
Hour.
Funny Girl, Wuthering Heights. It's like he's doing these dramas, but then you get this movie and it's like a chariot race, action, high stakes drama. And you're like, oh my God. Okay.
And he's so good at it. Incredible. Yeah. Should we talk about the chariot race sequence? Since, like,
I will say
here?
Just for him, for Wyler, it was the highest, like his quote was the highest quote for a director at the time when he signed on for this movie. It was the most money they had ever given
that
a director.
That seems right. Yeah. That's like, right. He was probably like, okay, this is not my bag, so I'm going to, if I fail, at least
money.
I need money.
At least I need
exactly,
money.
Exactly, well, exactly.
Yeah, it was obviously, like, it was intended to be on the scale that it ended up being. It's not like this was necessarily an overblown
right.
production. I mean, they were trying to, Charlton Heston wasn't even their first choice. They were going after Paul Newman and Rock Hudson and, like,
Brando.
Leslie Nielsen and Brando. Yeah, and, like, all of those
Imagine
people turned
Leslie
it down.
Nielsen in this is...
I mean,
really hard to say.
I'm thinking about Paul Newman in this movie.
Paul
hot.
Newman. The thing is,
hot.
Paul Newman would have been gay. Like,
yes!
He would have done it.
He
would have played
oh,
gay.
Look.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Woke. Say we want to talk about some woke kings.
Love yeah. Paul Newman.
I yeah, love him. Paul he Newman. Was trying to get this, like, gay romance film off the ground for so long, and he could, like, never get it done because of the time. And obviously, like, well, we won't dive too much into Paul Newman's personal
we'll,
see, life, but
we'll
suffice
cover
to
Paul
say
Newman.
Yeah,
you will.
No, Paul Newman, you
I
know.
Mean Butch Cassidy,
yeah. Yes,
the man has definitely some queer-coded things in his
yeah.
you know, filmography.
He rocks. I love him. He's the best. He would have been great in this. And I do think that Charlton Heston is very good in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
But they're basically like, this movie is like the Ten Commandments comes out and MGM goes like, I want what Paramount did. And so they like, that's essentially literally like the quest is to like recreate the Ten Commandments, not literally recreate the Ten Commandments, but like have your biblical epic
that is also a character study,
mm-hmm.
Which is what the Ten Commandments is, and has like mind-blowing action sequences like the parting of the Red Sea. And they did it.
They
got it done. So the chariot
yeah,
race,
so the chariot race.
I, oh
my
God.
Favorite part. I mean, I don't know, but you,
it's
just it's
like,
how,
yeah.
how? I kept saying that. Literally, I was like, probably scared my cat. I was yelling, like, how are they doing this? How did they do this? Because how? Like,
it's,
oh my God.
It's amazing. It really is. It's so, like, precisely directed, precisely shot. It is so well edited. It is so thrilling. And, you know, and like, what, it was like 3 months to shoot it or
yeah.
something?
So, I mean, I'll just quickly That's rattle amazing. Through the facts because it took a year of them to build the set. It cost $1 million. They imported 78 foreign horses. 7,000 mm-hmm. extras were used in the stands. But while they were they basically were driving on a small Italian car in front. Like, but the way that, like, as we were talking about, like, with the aspect ratio for the camera, they were shooting on 65 stock with like the wide aspect ratio, but the lenses that they had didn't give a huge depth of field. And so they only had like limited time to capture the action before, because the horses were going too freaking fast. So they couldn't keep up with their car. So they had to then get another car that had a better, stronger engine to like get a little more ahead of the horses. But it's basically like shooting seconds at a time of the race, which is just incredible to think about. And then you have the gigantic, of course, like matte paintings, which you have that like fill like the rest of the world.
I also like, I have to point out the little like dolphin things that are every round. I was obsessed with those as a kid. I'm like, can I have little dolphin like things to like mark the days in my house or something? I don't know.
I'm
something.
Sure they sell them somewhere.
I need to find them. They're amazing.
It's such a smart, like that's like such a basic detail. That's such a smart way of like grounding what's happening with the race instead of, I mean, I wouldn't expect them to do like overt voiceover or something like that, but that kind of thing where it's like, and there's only one lap left. Like it's a perfect, super simple visual device. Nice and clean, and it tells you everything you need to know. I mean, it's like the coldest take of all time, but I was just so riveted watching this. Good sequence is good.
One of the best sequences. Confirmed.
But like, I could not look away. The first guy that gets trampled by his horses, I had to like, my hands were over my mouth. Like, I was truly so stressed this whole chariot race. Yeah.
That's intense. And when, Masala starts cheating and you're like, like that's a moment, like you think it's gonna be fine, you think they're just gonna like, you know, measure their dicks again, but this time with their horses, and then you see the spikes and you're like, Masala, you little bitch, like you are crossing the line here, like,
and I love that he like doesn't hide it too, because he like flaunts it, like they cut to a close-up of it and he cut it, like they move like the, it like shakes a little, so it's like, aha, look what I have, and you're like, oh,
and
no,
he doesn't even succeed.
No,
it's like you cheated and you didn't even succeed.
Don't fight dirty.
He ends up dead because of it.
Yeah. Oh, God. When he got flipped and I was like, oh, shit. I thought it was going to be a little closer than that. And then he immediately got trampled by two sets of horses. I was like, oh, my God.
The horses going over him more than once. You know, everyone makes fun of that scene in Meet Joe Black.
The cars.
Like, go back to Ben-Hur, man. It's the same intense, like... That he was like, you know what? We need two horses. We
right,
need
not
to just
once.
Really make it clear that he is not coming back from this.
Right, because you have the dummy before that gets trampled with the one horse, and you're like, oh, and everyone like reacts, and you have the guys run out, and they bring them back off,
stretcher.
And they're like making sure that they don't get trampled, which is also very funny.
Another element of the chariot race that I really love is like the people with the stretchers and how tense that is, because you essentially have one lap to get injured people off of this giant track of nine different, you know, teams of horses before you're all dead.
Right.
I don't know. It's
and
crazy.
And they don't always make it, too. Like, they get real close to being hit a few times. It's intense.
The whole bit when Ben-Hur has to jump his horses over the fallen chariot climb back into his chariot. Oh, my God. It's just – and I love the lack of score during the whole thing, and they apparently did all of the audio in post-production because it was too difficult to try and get sound during this point. I think it makes it like so stressful and really incredible, like in something that you expect to be, you know, epic and like overarching, that there's just no audio.
I think in like a more contemporary film would have over orchestrated the score there. They would have leaned into, you know, like a John Williams swell or something, and instead, you know, Wyler was very smart in that he wanted to ramp up that tension. And so it's just, like you said, that intense sound design. You can hear the sand, you can hear the horses, you can hear the hooting of the like Roman, you know, crowd. It is it's so good.
It rocks.
God, it's so good. You don't have, like, I was trying to think of sequences like this today where you can just feel how real, and it's like the Mission Impossible franchises, I feel like, the only one that is like giving me sort of this energy that I want, where I feel like the actual gravity and stakes
of
to like what's going on. Like, I was nervous for these people. I'm like, are you, this is dangerous what you're doing,
a huge cornerstone of what the Mission Impossible franchise is built on is watching Tom Cruise risk his life over and over. Yeah. Right. And when I was watching Ben-Hur, I was like, these are real horses.
Right.
That are trampling people. Yeah.
Mission Impossible wise, the scene where Tom Cruise is actually climbing a building. Yes. In, mm-hmm. Is it 3 or 4? I don't know.
It's 4. The old Ghost Protocol.
Ghost Protocol.
Ghost Protocol. Yeah. I saw that in IMAX and I was like, I almost vomited. It was just terrifying. Mm-hmm. And I, like, Tom Cruise, what are you doing?
Right.
But I think he's one of the last, like, he probably is going to die doing a film stunt. And
that's probably
it.
How he wants
and
to
he'll,
go out.
I was he'll gonna love say. It. You know? Absolutely. But he's like the last. He's the last of these kind of actors who are willing to, and maybe it's a good thing. I don't know. You probably shouldn't die for a movie, but maybe not. I don't know. Yeah. He seems like he wants to. I mean, he's going to space, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. So.
If he wants to live his truth, then I wish him well. You know? I really do.
Boyd, which is insane, is that he was doing a lot of his own stunts for like this.
For the chariot
and like throughout
business?
The movie. Yeah, which
Dang.
Is like the man.
Where is the Oscar?
He deserved the goddamn Oscar for this movie.
He did. He carries the movie.
Yeah.
Which is also why, no offense to The Last Hour, it's also why The Last Hour is a little hard to get through because,
yes,
like, Masala was carrying the movie.
No, every time you cut away from the Masala drama and you like and you go to the Jesus subplot, I'm like, I want Masala, or I don't care about, like, necessarily what's going on in Ben-Hur's life. Like, I want to know about the interpersonal drama between these two, and because it's so much more potent.
One thing I noticed on my last rewatch this last Easter was that, so Masala has this like left-hand man named Drusus.
Yes.
And like Drusus is like also in love with Masala, and he is always being rejected, and like always, and he's always on the side, like going, you know, I'm right here. And then when he's dying and he's waiting for Judah, like Drusus is right there, right? Like, yeah. Drusus is actually there for him. And then when Judah shows up, Drusus gives him like this look of like, you ruined mm-hmm. the love of my life's life.
Yeah.
And it
yeah.
is like, I want like, you're gonna reboot Ben-Hur. I want it from Drusus's point of view of like watching this drama and realizing that like they could have been happy together if he'd just get over his ex, you know?
Literally. That's essentially Where's what's that happening. Movie? He won't let the Roman save his life because he's so invested in having this man at his side one last time.
It's really crazy.
Yeah. Like that's true love right there. It's deeply tragic, but it's definitely this deep emotional connection that he doesn't have with anybody else.
It's what plays out with the bathhouse scene. It's like where they're all like getting their back massages, all these half naked men, and then they walk in and they start talking about Ben-Hur, and he's immediately like, I gotta, like, this is like every, like, the stakes get raised for him anytime Ben's name is mentioned. He's like, I care 12 times as much as I did before.
Yes, there's nothing more important to me than what this man is up to. I mean, literally, I'm obsessed with the fact that Ben-Hur comes back from the dead approximately 5 times, if not more.
Yes.
He just keeps coming back.
He just keeps appearing. Living. And Masala's like, you're still alive? I mean, every time Esther's like, I'd never see you again. Masala's like, oh, hey, dude, you're back. Right, isn't that great? Why don't we have another ideological discussion leading up
to this
chariot
race? That's like the whole business, too, with like Ben-Hur not knowing that his mom and his sister are lepers, and like he thinks they're dead, and you're like, no one's really dying in this movie. It's just like,
you should
everyone
know
should
better,
just
sir.
Tell them. I'm like, Ben, you should be dead.
Yes, I agree very much, though, Mariah, with what you said about how The Last Hour is kind of a drag, because the middle sequence with the boat, the sea battle,
ramming speed,
yes,
ramming speed.
Battle speed.
It's so wild that that's how people used to fight. Like, I know. Like, wow, ancient history take, but oh my god, it's just like, we're gonna ram these two immovable objects into each other see who wins.
I think it's really smart for the movie to like stay in the galley for the most part, and to actually see the rowers on the other ship mm-hmm. as well, and like have a lot of the battle strategy be involved in basically like taking over that source of labor, because that is what is going to sink your ship. Like, right. I don't know. That's just something that you don't really think about with these like giant tactical battles. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting perspective to come at it from.
Totally. It's giving it like the people who are going to like die, yeah. probably, instead of like the commanders.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you don't really, there's barely anything about like the actual strategy. Like you said, they're just kind of going to ram the boats together.
Right.
Yeah.
That's why I think like I like Master and Commander, or like things like that. Like, these like naval things where you actually get to like see like the intricacies of like how these fights are playing out versus just like, it's a fight, look how cool.
Right.
You know,
you battle strategy, I'm all about that. I think that's why the chariot race is so good too, because like, mm-hmm. You get into the minutia of like, how are you going around these turns, and like, you know, there's that moment where the chariot wheels like go up on the wall and all the guards have to jump out of the way. It's
And earlier when Judah meets the horses, mm-hmm. and he observes why they're not working correctly, because he's got the wrong horses, and he's like, you need to move this horse to there and put that horse here, and that way, you know, centrifugally they'll pull it better going around the curves. And you're right. Like, wait a minute, they're doing math with horses now. And I love that they show that that's how you figure that out.
Yeah.
Like, and that's why Judo is such a good charioteer. And you know that like Masala was not thinking about that when he was putting his horses and his little knives or whatever on his wheels.
Yeah, he's just gonna cheat his way there. I mean, chariot riding is like an insane sport.
Have you ever done?
Of course not. I'm pretty sure it's illegal.
According to my mom, who read this book, there's like a whole section, this movie could be like an 8-hour movie because the book is huge.
Mini series.
There's a whole section of Judah like winning, you know, they talk about it, they just sort of cut to it, and it's like, oh yeah, he won all of the circus in Rome stuff. Like that actually happens, like,
in the book. Cool. Oh my god.
Yeah,
like they talk about him doing all of those races and building that reputation to the part that shows up in the bathhouse. Like, that's actually in the book.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll get a mini series of Ben-Hur or something.
I think I'm much more inclined to like mini series reboots of things
versus
a feature reboot. Yeah. Because it lets go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think like most movies, you know, aren't long enough just in terms of like, books are really complicated.
Yes.
Unless it's like a 120-page book, like, a 2 to 3 hour movie is usually not enough to do the whole plotting of it. And that's why they're different mediums. But like a mini series, I think, can often get more, still keep you entrenched because it's episodic, but is able to do better in terms of adapting all of the little plot pieces that you love from whatever book it is.
Yeah. Right. And like it feels much more of like an organic creative endeavor to take like an iconic work like Ben-Hur and try to reinterpret it through a different media style, mm-hmm. as opposed to like the 2016 remake is 2 hours long, so I assume they cut out a lot. Probably most, I haven't seen it, but like probably a lot of the leper subplot, which is truly like an hour and a half of the 4-hour movie. If not more.
Right.
But it's like, it's the same basic thing.
JK?
Yeah, seriously. Like, the chariot race is probably still, like, at the climactic point, and it still starts the same way. Like, you know, with a miniseries, it allows you to, like, more closely explore the, you know, the mini episode arcs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Look, there are some things that just shouldn't be remade point blank.
Probably shouldn't do this one.
No, like, no.
It is wild that all of the drama really, like, obviously it starts with the breakup, but that it's all about, like, bad tiling. And, like, essentially the crux of this movie is, like, if their roof didn't fall, like, would anything have happened?
If this jabroni had installed the roof tiles correctly, we wouldn't be having this problem. I love when movies do that.
It's
sometimes
so funny.
They lean too much into it and they're like, don't you think it's crazy how all this came from this one little thing? But I like movies like this where it's not really acknowledged.
No, Masala just goes up and like pushes one and he's like, oops, oh, well, I guess it is.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Ugh. It shows what a... like angry spurned lover he was, that he saw this is shitty tiling. She wasn't actually trying to kill the governor, but you know what, I don't like him so anymore. I'm right. gonna ruin his life.
He broke up with me, therefore I will not defend him.
Yeah. I'm gonna ruin not just his life, but everyone who loves him. It's like, dang.
Oh,
nothing more scary than a scorned lover.
I know.
Yeah.
Once again, robbed of the Oscar.
Truly
robbed.
It is just for like on like as a last touch point on production. When they started, Wyler, because they were constantly writing as they were going and rewriting because the script was sort of so far and they were trying to figure out how to do it. He had only read 10 to 12 pages of the script when they started rolling camera. Which blows my mind. Like, and they'll talk about that with Mission Impossible as well. Wow, a lot of weird carryover. Yeah. But like they'll just start like sort of rolling with scenes and they'll be like, okay, we're gonna like make this as we go, and like we'll plot as like we start shooting. And it's like, that is so stressful in my brain and to think about. And over the course of the shooting, it also that it said that it got so grueling that they had to be given shots and like an injections of vitamins.
Dang.
To sort of keep them afloat and like going, because they're shooting, you're shooting in the hot sun for 9 months on end, and it's stressful, like in like all of the moving parts. Like, I cannot imagine what that was like.
Yeah,
it's just impossible to even comprehend.
Yeah, I know. I just, yeah, it's, that's probably one of the reasons why these movies are a little more out of fashion now, is because like it really is like it takes over your life. I mean, I think about a lot of people talk about like the filming of Mad Max Fury Road, which was by all accounts a very well run set, but was incredibly grueling.
Right.
And basically you had to pack up and move your family to the desert for 18 months.
Yeah.
And then you had to go shoot in said desert every day for like 12 hours.
Right.
Like, it really is intense. And so I understand the appeal of being like, oh, I just have to go to the studio that's 5 minutes away from my house.
Right. And I'll sit in the green screen room and we're done.
Yeah. And you know, I just got to look at some people and do the little acting thing, and then I get to go home and I get $20 million.
Yeah.
Dollars.
Yeah.
I understand the appeal.
Totally. Seeing these sets though, don't you, like, I always thought about this growing up. I was like, I wish I could have visited one of these huge sets like this, Cleopatra, these things, like where it's like they build these monumental big things. I'm like, I would kill just to visit or to see the scale of that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like in the, when they go back to Rome or wherever they are and they like have the huge steps that they like have to walk up. I'm like that looks like so much, like that looks so cool. Like I want to see that. Like, why can't we just keep these sets built and like move them around and have like exhibits or something, you know?
Yeah,
it's a real bummer that most of them get destroyed. I know though that some of the sets that were built in like the African desert, not for this film, but for like some of the Star Wars sets and some of the other films that were shot in Africa over the decades, they just left.
Right.
They just left it.
And I mean, yeah, like, you can go visit, like, yeah, for, I think, yeah, like the whole Star Wars like Tatooine, I think you can like see
like,
the buildings.
Can I just go hang out in Tatooine for like a day?
Would be iconic.
Sounds
I would
great.
Love that.
That would be fun.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, and it just must be so incredibly immersive as, you know, a creative force behind the camera, but also in front of the camera,
must,
to be like,
oh my God,
you step out of your trailer and you literally step into ancient Jerusalem.
Movie, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it makes, like, you think about, like, it's so hard to act with a green screen. You don't know what's behind you or anything. So you're like seeing this is like, my God, I can act. You know, and it's like, you don't have to think about acting in your environment. You're in the environment. So all you have to think about is just, how am I emotionally going to transpose this character's feelings?
Yeah, the environment's right there. And, like, obviously, there's a lot of really amazing, like, still practical stuff and a lot of, like, blended things. Like, you know, where the sets are still really expansive and they just, you know, it's CGI augmented.
Right.
But still, you
it's
know.
It's not the same.
If you want to get nostalgic.
I do think that that is one of the big differences. And you can, if you're really attuned to it, you can see, you can feel the difference in the acting in CGI heavy films versus films that had immersive sets.
Yeah.
And I think audiences, you know, contemporary audiences tend to not watch beyond what's new, right? Like, cinephiles are a small sliver of who watches movies. I think cinephiles tend to forget that they're a small sliver of who watches movies and they get a little weird about it.
Yes. Yes.
Your average person who watches movies, which is most people who watch movies, don't have the language to realize that what they're seeing isn't as, I don't want to say better because obviously it's personal, but isn't as grounded as what cinema used to be.
Right.
And obviously the cinephiles tend to be the ones that know the difference, and that's why they get so mad about Marvel versus Scorsese and what have you. And clearly, right. I love Scorsese. I love old films. I don't particularly like the Marvel films, but I understand why people do. And right. and I feel like it's kind of a folly to get mad at average moviegoers. The thing is, it's not a new phenomenon for average moviegoers to not know what good cinema is. That's the other thing I think people forget is like cinephile culture, the way it is now, was like came out of the 60s.
Yeah. Right.
The average moviegoers have always been average moviegoers. And they almost always liked crap.
People like just junk.
I even think about the movies that we consider obviously to be like absolute modern classics now. Like I saw a tweet the other day about like, wow, Blade Runner and The Thing came out at the theater like on the same weekend. What an incredible like box office. And people were like, yeah, both of those movies made no money.
Right.
Because nobody wanted to see them.
Right.
Yeah. And like those are two like incredibly enduring modern classics.
Yeah.
So yes, I think that is a very good reminder that like people have always wanted populist cinema. Yeah. Just the definition of populist cinema has obviously changed.
Yeah.
But I agree with the Gore Vidal's thoughts on this movie in that it's like a populist entertainment piece and not like the greatest important film of its time.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think just 2 points. One, on like the CGI thing, it's like I totally understand why we do it now, but it made me really think about Jurassic Park and how the first Jurassic Park dinosaurs look so
much better.
Good.
Yeah.
And how now, even though you're able to get such accurate CGI for some things, it's really, we talked about this before with like invisible CGI with David Fincher and how his CG is so good because it's really like small things that he's augmenting versus these big monsters. So now you have these dinos and you're like, these don't look as real as the puppets sort of that they were building.
Yeah.
But I think that ties back with Ben-Hur 2016 and that you're watching this chariot sequence and it's like CGI augmented goop and you don't feel the like tension or anything because you're so easy to tell like, okay, this wasn't practical. This wasn't like, you can't feel any real stakes to it. And even though they're trying to shoot it in a way that like sells it, it doesn't get around the fact that like you can't feel the propulsive like real energy of what's going on.
To your earlier point about like the most recent film to have something feel the way that this sequence is that scene in Mad Max.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know,
that it's like, what is that, it's like almost 20 minutes long too, right? That chase sequence.
And
it was practical, those were real cars, and they they really did that, and you really feel that. Now they did have the score; they did have more score there, but that score really, like, it goes
score,
so hard. It's
score
amazing.
Rules.
It works.
It's the best.
It totally
so
works.
Good.
Like that. I missed it when it was originally in theaters because 2015. I didn't watch any films directed by men for the whole year.
I'm truly obsessed with that.
It was a great year. Thankfully, because it became an Oscar film, they put it back in theaters. I got to see it. With Miller doing a Q&A, so it's actually much better.
All that rules.
And like that sequence, I understand why now all these people that summer were like, just cheat. And I was like, I'm not cheating. Like, I get why they were trying to get me to cheat.
Right.
That movie was worth it. And truly, because of the practical effects, like, you can just feel it in a visceral way that the CGI is, I think the human brain can tell when something is real and can tell when something is not. And it's a different feeling when you watch those CGI films, and they can still be entertaining, but not in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. I could not agree more. It's just, there's something very special and something very cinematic about sitting in a theater and, you know, having the knowledge that like this was real, like what you're watching is like incredibly authentic. It rocks. And, you know, I think that I have faith that there will be a little bit of more of a resurgence for practical effects. We'll see. I might end up eating my words.
I don't know about that.
But we can only hope. Should we talk about release?
How much money this made?
This movie made a crazy amount of money. I was at a small gathering last night, and I was like, oh, I have to get up early tomorrow because we're recording an episode on Ben-Hur. And someone was like, oh, is that, like, you know, would you consider that a four quadrant movie? And I was like, this movie was number one at the box office for 6 months and is the, was my the God. Second highest grossing movie. Now, to be fair, there was a lot less movies.
Right, but.
I know.
Imagine a movie running for 6 months number one.
And
what?
It was the second highest grossing movie of all time behind Gone with the Wind, which will never be surpassed. I looked up, I crunched some of the numbers. It made $74.7 million in box office sales when it came out, which calculated to today comes out to a nice little number of $691 million in first run. Yeah. So,
oh my God.
Absolutely crazy. And then they did like a big re-release.
And it's not even like Ben-Hur was a huge IP or anything. Like, yeah, it was a silent film and it was a book, but it wasn't like Gone with the Wind, which was a phenomenon when it was a book.
Right.
You know, went into 40 printings within 2 years or some crazy number. Like, that's monster numbers.
No, no, people, you're not going to say like Ben-Hur and people are like, oh my God, I read that classic from 1880. I can't wait to see it. Like, no.
Yeah. Also, I'm just saying this in a very like neutral statement way, but it is crazy to think that like a biblical movie could play like gangbusters for that long. Like, you could never do that now. And I don't mean that that's like a good thing or a bad thing or whatever. I just think it's really interesting to look at like what was like populist cinema.
How I would say the time has changed and how maybe like, I think this goes to say with like sort of the Hays Code and stuff. I think they're sort of hand in hand tied together where it's like a lot of this stuff is like subtextual. Like, and like, I wonder, like, I think like we were maybe a more religious, more conservative country at the time.
Oh, no question.
So,
wow, I thought you were going in the direction of being like superheroes or the new American Jesus, and I was like, I mean,
well, I mean, Zack Snyder thinks so. So,
yeah, made a lot of money. It saved MGM single-handedly from bankruptcy.
MGM, the studio that has been trying, well, now, you know, whatever, got bought, but was constantly like, are we going to go bankrupt? Are we not going to go bankrupt? Are we going bankrupt?
Must have been an exciting place to work. Good for William Wyler, you know? Yeah. He single-handedly saved
the
studio.
That huge payout.
Yeah. Whew. He deserves. Just
think about the residuals.
And he got the Oscar to boot.
So, Oscars, speaking of, as we said, 11 wins.
11 wins.
So, do we know every category that it got? It was,
yes, I do.
Actor, director, supporting actor. Or you want to just run it through?
For the wrong supporting performance.
I think we should just quickly say is that the man who won Best Actor in Supporting Role, Hugh Griffith, is in very offensive brown face in this movie, playing a sheik, a Middle Eastern sheik. So that's really great. And also, he's not very good.
And in an incredibly over-the-top stereotypical way.
Yes.
It's not great.
No.
It's hard to fathom.
I know. Yeah. Famously played in the remake by Morgan Freeman. So, I mean, a better decision.
Maybe I'll watch that movie.
I don't think I would make it. I mean, it stars Toby Kebbell and Jack Huston.
Something
like
Houston. Jack Huston is hot.
Jack
Huston was very good on Boardwalk Empire.
True.
He should be a character actor, not a lead star. He does not have the chops to lead a movie. He has the chops to do weird, faceless, sad PTSD. He's also the grandson of John Huston.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So he's from the Huston, because I think he's,
Angelica.
Angelica's his aunt. I'm not sure who his. I think his dad was not in the business. The one Huston kid that was like, I don't want to do this. But I mean, he's not. They keep trying to make him happen, and I'm like, just put him in character roles. He's really good in character roles.
So many young men's careers would be so much better if Hollywood was just like, I know you're hot, but we're going
to
make
you
a character
actor.
That's what Jude Law finally figured out.
Yes!
He started as a character actor, and then they were like, let's make you a star. And he's just like, okay, I'll try. And then
he's
doing
much better.
Character shit. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Honestly, I feel the same with Brad Pitt. I'm like, Brad Pitt is a great supporting character actor versus a leading man.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's like, you should just also let supporting actors be hot. Like, sorry.
Yes.
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 Well, don't say no to more hot people.
Right.
Like,
nothing wrong with that.
Hello. I fully agree. Okay. So.
So who else wins?
You want the Oscars rundown?
Give us the rundown.
All 11. Best Picture. Best Director. Best Lead Actor, Best Supporting Actor, Best Lead Actor for Charlton Heston, obviously. Best Art Direction, Set Direction, Color, specifically, because this is when they still had the black and white and color categories. Best Cinematography, Color.
Deserved.
Best Costume Design, Color.
Shocking.
Also deserved. I love the color in this movie. I think it's amazing.
It's stunning.
Best Special Effects, very well deserved. Best Film Editing, incredibly well deserved. Best Score, yes. And Best Sound Recording. So,
God.
All the hits. The only one that it lost was Best Screenplay.
So also what's interesting at the Golden Globes, which boo hiss Golden Globes, right?
Yeah, always.
Stephen Boyd won Best Supporting Actor.
Yes,
and it
he
was like,
did.
Damn it. They got it right at the Globes.
Every once in a while.
Did he piss off everyone in the Academy?
That's
like,
so,
I have so
annoying.
Many questions.
I feel like that's classic. Like, it's more proof that the Oscars have honestly always been the same. Is that they're like, who should we nominate? Like, young, passionate man or old guy doing brown face and an offensive stereotype. Seems like an easy choice.
You see this constantly, though. It's like all the time. I feel like we've talked about this before, where it's like
they
have the Globe nom and not the Oscar nom or something. Yeah. Like Cruz with his three Globes, and I'm like, my man has not won an Oscar yet. Get him an Oscar.
Cruz is never going to win an Oscar.
He will.
I hate to break
Cruz
it to you.
Cruz should have won for Magnolia. I'm just
Yeah.
I feel very strongly about that. He does more without saying a word with his eyes in that movie than most actors have done in their entire career.
You're
Tom Cruise has
Jordan's language.
The greatest eyes in cinema. He has the most intense eyes.
Yeah.
That sequence, and it is the wrong movie, but like that sequence when he's being interviewed and she gives him that really hard question about, I think it's his father, and it's like a minute of just his face reacting, and he goes through like 7,000 emotions, and you're like, how did he do that? PTA is an amazing actor's director is the thing, but
Speaking of Magnolia, also, I would say like an epic movie length of sorts, you know?
PTA has the epic movie gene for sure.
Oh, for sure.
But he does character studies instead of biblical epics.
Right.
Yes. I love it.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll be like one of his last movies. Is he just a gigantic biblical
epic?
He
leans full in.
Yeah.
I will watch it.
Yeah. We talked about Black Swan just a couple of weeks ago, and like the closest thing I guess we have to
Noah.
A biblical epic is Noah in recent memory, because all of the nativity stuff usually ends up like skewing extremely family friendly
or very like religious, like Christian, like I think like they're so
like
all that
too Christian to be four
Christian
quadrant.
Production companies pumping out all those like Christian religious movies are so fascinating,
deeply fascinating,
deeply scary,
because every once in a while there's like a big crossover hit like God's Not Dead or whatever,
right? And
it's
you're
so
like,
interesting,
how did that movie get Oscar noms and money?
It's so interesting. I think about it often. It's just, you know, it's what we were saying about like what viewers want. You can never
we always forget
really
about the middle
predict.
Of the country.
Hey, it's not just the middle of the country.
That's true. But anyways,
any final thoughts on Ben-Hur before we move into wrap-up?
I mean, I think my biggest things will come with the queerness when we get there.
Okay, cool.
But then I guess, we do see... It is wild that they literally just show the entire story of Jesus. They're just like, born, here's where he died.
Was crucified. He does perform a posthumous miracle on Ben-Hur's family to unleper them, so... good for them. It kind of comes out of nowhere.
That score at the end there, when he is like, he's dead and there's the rain and then the rainbow happens and that score swells and then suddenly Tears is like, my face or whatever it is she says. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Oh, it's very like beautiful. Ugh. And it's actually weird because they do like a pretty accurate Stations of the Cross here. Obviously, like I almost said the Last Temptation of Christ. That's not correct. The Passion of the Christ. The Passion of the Christ is like very well known for being like hyper accurate to like all the little like biblical things, but like they go through a bunch of like the biblical like stops and starts of
they
like
do.
The crucifixion.
And I like how they bookend Jesus giving Ben-Hur water.
Yes.
When he's not supposed to get water, and then that Station of the Cross where someone gives him water is Ben. It's like, whoops, now it's Ben-Hur.
Oops, it's Ben-Hur. Yeah,
we mixed him in.
That made me laugh so hard.
Oh,
it's,
I thought
it's
it was great.
Fan
I loved
fiction.
It is literally fan fiction. Like, it is Bible fan fiction. I'm obsessed with it. I think it's great.
That's the niche is you.
I know.
You are the person that's for.
I was appreciating this. Also, it's like, I know, like, these weird ins and outs has been drilled into my brain from years of Catholic school. So I was like, oh, cool. I see what they're doing here.
That's so funny.
It's basically like the equivalent of me being like, I understood that reference. Boom. There you go.
I think to that point, like, so I grew up in the Episcopal Church, and which is like the, you know, split. There's the Catholicism and then the Episcopal, and they're the closest you get to being similar without. And Stations of the Cross is a thing I did growing up. Like, you would do that. And I think that this movie is more religious if you're familiar with the religiosity of it. But it's not, it, like, some of those Christian movies are like, over the head, this is Christian, right? And you're like, you know, it's if you're not a religious person, they're hard to watch, right?
Right.
Whereas this one, the religiosity is there if you want it, just like the queerness is there if you want it, but it's also not there if you don't need it, and it doesn't hit you over the head with it.
I agree.
Yeah, it really is funny.
It's very successful.
Because it is the equivalent of being like, oh, I read the book and I understand, like, this little thing that people that didn't read the book wouldn't understand. Like, that's essentially what it is. Like, the shot of Pontius Pilate washing his hands after he condemns Jesus is like a Bible thing that you don't know unless you know.
It's like, all it's there if you want it,
over my
but
head.
It's not there if you don't want it.
Yeah
I'm like, I mean, as the non-religious one or whatever, I like didn't pick up on the small things and it, but like sometimes I, as you were saying, like ultra religious stuff will bump with me because I have like my own personal feelings and stuff like that, but like I didn't find this hard or annoying to watch.
I
think because people, I think that's one reason people don't watch it, is they think it's gonna hit them over the head
with
religious symbolism and kind of like the Passion of the Christ does.
Yeah,
and it doesn't. It really, like, if you don't want it to be religious, it doesn't have to. It really isn't.
It's more historical than anything.
Yeah, it's like a period piece.
Yeah, it's a period piece that happens to include the period of time when the Bible was taking place.
Right.
Like, yeah. It's
Jesus
good.
Jesus is a supporting character.
Yes.
He's just there, existing.
I love that you never see his face. Famously, in the remake, he's played by Rodrigo Santo, and you see a bunch of that man's face, because how are you going to cast Rodrigo Santo and not
Xerxes
show his
himself.
Face? Sexy motherfucker.
He has amazing hair in this movie.
Yes,
he does.
What is his shampoo? Like, what is
he
doing?
We gotta know what that regimen was.
Drop the hair care routine at Jesus. Where's the YouTube? But I love that you never see his face. I think that is a good thematic choice.
Yeah.
That sort of adds to, like, making sure that this movie doesn't feel like it's beating you over the head as well. And like you said earlier, Mariah, a lot of good reaction shots because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And Heston in particular has some great... just great faces.
He's a good movie. I think just in general reaction actor, everything, like, he's always very good at just being like, oh my god, whoa, damn you, like everything he's doing is just flamboyant
a scene where he just like falls.
Yes.
I made a gif of it because it's amazing, and he in the frame, the camera doesn't move, like it's stationary, and he just falls out of the frame so dramatically. It's my favorite.
I'm obsessed with when he dramatically hides behind the rock
at
like the Valley of the Lepers or whatever.
He's so good. Like pressed up like they shan't see me.
And it's the same thing, it's just a very wide shot, so he's like doing
you
the
see
most
the whole thing. Maybe that's his Heston only does the most.
He always does the most, but it's good.
That's so funny.
I love it.
Oi.
Okay. Well,
shall we guess the letterbox?
Yes. Mariah, you are welcome to put in a guess, but you do not have to.
I'm actually so unsure where the hell this thing's landing.
Is Letterboxd out of 5?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's out of 5 with decimals. I'm going to go ahead. You know, I think that enough people are probably like a 3.5 to a 4 on this. I'm sure there's a sprinkling of 5s, but like, I think I would be hard pressed to see a lot of people giving it 5. So I'm going to go like split the difference, and I'm going to say like a 3.7.
Okay. A 3.7. Mariah, would you like to put it
in? Also going to say 3.7. That's crazy.
Okay.
So, we can double down on 3.7.
Yeah.
All right, guys. I mean, I have some slightly unfortunate news. It's a 3.9.
Oh.
You were very close.
Wow.
That was close.
Yeah.
Actually, higher than expected.
A 3.9. I mean, I was like, I wasn't sure what to rate this because I was like, it really is like very affecting. Even if I, even if I wouldn't be like, oh, Ben-Hur, my comfort movie. I was like, it's very undeniable.
That's
I would give it a 5.
Yeah.
And also, it has been on my like 100 favorite movies list forever.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Good movie. Hey, but Ben-Hur, good movie.
Partly because I grew up with it, and partly because every time I watch it, I love it as much as the first time I watched it. So.
Yeah.
Right. It only gets gayer.
It really does only get gayer because I keep noticing more things that other actors are doing. Like the Drusus thing, I never noticed how much Drusus is hanging on Missala the whole time. He loves him so much. Like, poor Drusus. He probably would have been a better boyfriend.
Oh, for sure.
You got to get over your toxic ex, you know? Sometimes it's just not going to work out.
That's what the thesis of this movie is.
So many movies that we toxic ex. So many movies that we cover, it's like, you just got to drop him. Yeah. Like, that is... I think of Interview with the Vampire all the time.
Classic.
It's like, if you could just get over your toxic ex, you could have a nice, healthy relationship.
With Antonio, like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh God. Oh, that movie. I'm having a lot of feelings about that movie. Okay. Speaking of the queerness, let's go around and give our QQ ratings.
We're throwing a spear.
Let's see how close we can get.
Yes.
Ooh. Okay. I'm not going to lie. The queer subject in this movie blew me away. I was not expecting very much, and I feel like they gave me everything. Obviously, like, it was during a much more contentious time, so a little means a lot. I feel like you mentioned that, Jordan, way back in our Rebecca episode.
Right.
And just to hear, obviously, everything with Gore Vidal, who, in addition to being a legend, was openly bisexual and, like, you know, advocated for all these things at a time when it was very rare that you could advocate for that on such a large scale, and to just see everything that Boyd is playing, and as Mariah so lovingly pointed out, all the different mini plots that you can get in there too. Overall, it's doing it for me. I'm gonna give it a 4.5.
4.5. Wow,
super high. I don't know. I feel really good about it.
I like it,
Jordan. How about you?
Just to be clean to the point, I think that Vidal's, what he said and just everything that you're reading into it, I mean, it's impossible not to see Boyd giving the ugly eyes to Heston. And I mean, we summed it up pretty cleanly. I'm going to go with a 4. I think, though, that this is a very concrete queer classic. And I think that if you're going to watch this movie, it's really, especially for me, it was a really fun revisiting it with a queer lens.
Yeah.
Having not seen it in so long. It was really eye-opening, I think.
Rock and roll.
Yeah.
Mariah, what are you feeling?
I'm also going to give it a 4.5. I think it can't go the full 5 just because of Heston. I think
yeah.
it just can't.
Heston's really all probably, force against it. He's like, I will
it
not.
It would be a 5 if it was Paul Newman, because Paul Newman would have just leaned in.
Yes.
But I can't not see it as a queer film. I like, the more, again, every time I rewatch it every Easter, I have seen it countless times, and it just, like, everything gets gayer. Esther, we didn't really talk too much about Esther, but, like, Esther is, like, Esther's in love with Ben-Hur, but Ben-Hur owned her.
Yeah.
So that's the whole
no good.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like, oh, you're going to get married, but you've had a crush on me my whole life. I'm going to free you for your dowry. It's like, what?
Yeah.
Okay.
Ew. Yeah.
So, like, there's a whole other layer of, like, did Esther really love him, or was there this weird, you know, master-slave thing going on there? I don't even know.
Yeah.
Complicated power dynamics.
It's really weird. And then Esther takes care of his family and...
Right.
It's a whole thing.
Is Ben-Hur bisexual also? Or was he asexual and that's why everyone was into him because no one could have him? It's hard to say.
Many thoughts. Yeah.
You have raised a lot of points here that are all very salient.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that this is a text that can be, like, analyzed over and over again, and you can
and
look at
it. And the most
yeah.
loving he ever is to anything in the whole 3 hours is the horses.
That's, yes.
He loves those horses.
When those horses come in, his eyes open. He's like, I care about these horses so much. And Brooke, Is that how you felt when the horses came on screen?
It was not, because I actually don't like horses very much.
I don't like horses either.
That's a lie.
Okay, so Mariah, for a little bit of context, my sister is a very good equestrian rider, but I don't like horses very much. However, both my sister and Jordan are very fond of saying that I have the horse girl energy of the family,
which you do.
I think is deeply rude. But yeah,
horses,
I mean,
don't like me.
Yeah.
They hate me. I grew up in a cow town full of horses. I have never met a horse that liked me.
Oh.
No, horses are extremely finicky, and it's like they can smell fear. They know.
I think that's what it is. I'm scared of horses, and they know that I'm scared, and so they try to make me extra scared to mess with me.
You got
to
give big yeehaw energy to make them.
You do. It's not even horse girl energy. Like, you do have to show that you like are one with the horse.
You got to be like,
you got to be the horse whisperer.
You got to be a spirit.
Ben Hur is a horse girl. What can
he
we say?
Is.
Him and Aragorn. Yes.
Ben Hur confirms horse girl
of epic cinema. I mean, look, he literally gifts Masala a horse. Do you ever just give your boyfriend a horse?
Okay, you know what? I'm saying maybe 4 or 5 for me.
4.5
I'm
you're walking
I'll
it
boost
back.
It up.
Okay.
4 or 5s across
well,
the board.
Aren't you glad that we started talking about a horse girl so that we could boost that rating for you?
Absolutely.
Oh my god.
Wow.
A good time.
We did it.
Mariah, we
Ben Hurd.
Thank you so much for being here and for talking about this epic with us.
Truly
this
a delight.
This was so much fun. I never get to talk about, like, once a year I get to talk about Ben Hur. So twice this year,
hey,
I get to talk about Ben Hur. It's amazing.
We're here to serve. And you are such an incredible writer and have delivered some of my favorite articles over the time that I have been following you on Twitter. So if people want to read more of your writing and learn more about you, where should they find you?
Probably starting with Twitter is a good place. It's at Old Films Flickr. And I have a link there to my link tree. It's got all my articles. At some point, I'm going to get my act together and like have like a portfolio website, you know, because I was in marketing for like 10 years and I just had my blog and it was really easy to be like, go read my blog.
Yeah.
But then I left marketing and now I'm doing freelance and now I'm like, my bylines are all over the place and it makes that a little more difficult to tell people where they can read my writing. But that's a good place. My blog is cinema-fanatic.com. And a lot of those articles are terrible, but I refuse to take them down because I believe in showing your flaws and showing your growth as a writer. So
yes.
I also believe in that. I think
that's our podcast summed up right there.
Yeah.
I started writing in 2009 and on that website. And some of the articles from back then are actually good, but most of them are terrible. But I wrote so many of them. Like, I used to have a feature called Oscar Vault Monday, and every Monday I would write about something that was nominated but didn't win. And I did that for years. There's like 200 of those articles. I'm not taking them down.
No.
They might not be great. I refuse to reread them, but they're there if you want to see what I thought when I was not a great writer about. I probably wrote one not about Ben Hur, so what would I have done in 59? I don't know. Room at the Top or something.
Yeah.
But
Ben Hur was like, I'm winning everything.
Ben Hur won everything. You know,
it won.
Oh, I wrote
short
one about
film.
The Ten Commandments because the Ten Commandments didn't win.
Boom!
So.
There you go.
Which is wild.
So that's where you can. But I think I spend most of my energy on Twitter. Unfortunately, it used to be Tumblr. Tumblr was my
I got you. Don't you worry. I understand.
I'm still on Tumblr. I haven't closed Tumblr in like 13 years. But I, you know,
it's just the energy transfer.
Yeah.
One point, I was. Listed as one of the 80 best Tumblrs by BuzzFeed.com. So,
hey,
boom.
Back
okay.
When that was like a thing.
We have a Tumblr celeb on the pod.
I know, a true Tumblr celeb. I will not be disclosing.
I do sometimes have people come up to me and ask if I am Old Film Flickr from Tumblr, and I'm like, yes.
Yeah, I am.
Wow.
I guess it happens.
Iconic.
I actually, I will not be disclosing my Tumblr or anything relating to it, but I actually do think that I follow you on Tumblr.
Oh my God.
Tumblr, I will never, like, my heart is on Tumblr. I just love it. But, you know, they did the big purge, and one of my big things on there was I used to catalog full frontal nudity in cinema. That was like a
hell yeah
thing, right?
And, yeah.
I had to save that whole archive to a folder because they were going to delete them all. And I was like,
That's upsetting.
How dare you?
It sucks. The Purge was so unfortunate. We'll discuss it. I mean, yeah. It was so bad for so many reasons, but whatever. You remember this, don't you, Jordan?
I do.
Female presenting nipples. Mm-hmm. I'll talk about it off mic.
Like, yeah, there's still sometimes things that will get flagged that I'm like,
what is this?
Really?
Yeah.
Why are you flagging this?
Their flagging system is terrible. It's fine. I still go on Tumblr for all of my drama. If I like can't properly track the drama on Twitter, you got to go to Tumblr, and they always know.
And I mean, Tumblr is still the best place for visual representation of fandom.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my opinion, if a movie has an active fandom, there are still GIF sets and fan art on Tumblr.
I'll tell you, that's where we post GIFs to Twitter, and I always go check. I searched Ben Hur on Tumblr last night to see if I could find the wine drinking GIF, and I found it.
Of course. Yeah. I'm sure there's fanfic out there.
Oh, absolutely. I'll check out Archive of Our Own after this. But yeah, it exists. Look, this movie is an enduring classic. What can we say? Tumblr loves this movie. Okay, amazing.
I love that.
If you also want to find us, we're a little less exciting, but don't go to Tumblr, because I will never reveal that. But
maybe that'll be like a big reveal. We'll save it for an episode down the line.
No, I mean,
episode 200?
I think not.
300?
We are on Twitter.
600?
We're on Twitter. I'm at Brooke B. Solomon.
At Jordan H. Gus.
And we're together at Queer Quadrant. And you can find this podcast on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you get your podcast. Please rate. Please review. Please give us a follow. 5 spears only.
5 chariots only.
5 chariots only. 5
dolphin right. bells.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. And, you can also tweet at us. We will make sure that we quote tweet Mariah's amazing queer subtext thread. But you should also tweet at us and tell us, what you think about this movie, or maybe what you would like to see us cover in the future. If you have
maybe
some
like
other
next week
homoerotic, classics you care about, let us know. But next week,
which is going to be,
it really is a homoerotic queer classic.
It is
slightly more recent, but next week we are covering The Lost Boys.
How lost? Completely.
We'll find out. I have not seen this.
I have.
Okay. Ooh. I'm excited.
Lost Boys is good.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
Very fun.
We
briefly
mentioned Interview with the Vampire, so we get to dip our toes back into the vampire
waters.
The fangs
are coming out, baby.
I'm excited. So that is next week. Tune in. It's going to be a great time.
2 iconic posters in a row, Ben-Hur and Lost Boys.
Heck yeah.
Very excited.
Yeah.
And Brooke, do you have anything you'd like to leave our audience with?
Yeah, I mean, I think that religion, specifically Christianity, would be a lot more widespread if in your moment for help you asked for Jesus and he literally appeared in front of you to offer you a cup of water.
Yes.
Like, no wonder this film was so popular. Yeah. That's what prayer is all about, ostensibly.